welcome, welcome. Episode 21 of the podcast here on Bright Side of the Sun. Chris Habis, as always. Jim Kochenour, riding co-pilot with me, as always, as well. Like I said, episode 21. We're not too far off of the Phoenix Suns' actual win total, and we started podcasting about halfway through the season. So, Jim, we will catch them, and basketball is still being played. So do these wins still count towards our running total?
I don't see why not. The Suns could still have a chance to get some wins themselves here as the summer progresses if they can do the right thing with their GM hiring and make the right picks on draft day. So we can still tally some of those in the win column for them and still keep our contest going in the good faith with that type of stuff as peripheral considerations.
Yeah, and the thing with the podcast is, you know, you can't say that you've made progression unless you go from average to good, good to great, great to whatever you want to call it. The one thing you can say about the podcast, at least we've progressed. It hasn't regressed. We haven't fell stagnant, I hope. And we're going to continue progressing. You know, we've had some great guests on with Kendall Marshall, with Channing Frye, with Marcus Morris, with Jared Dudley. So, you know, continuing to continue delivering as the summer is going on. Hopefully having some front office guys on. And speaking of front office, we all know Lance Blanks is gone. We know that Lon Babby is evaluating the head coach and the general manager situation. We'll have some news/insight on that as we're going through the podcast. But I'd like to actually, we're going to have another guest on here today, and we're going to continue delivering. And a guy who actually worked for the Phoenix Suns from, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from 06 to 2012, currently writing for ESPN right now. You got to pay to read him, which, you know, has to say something positive about him. Amin Elhafin, got you on the line. We're going to talk Suns. We're going to talk front office. How are you doing today?
How's it going, gentlemen? Good, Amin. Thanks for coming on the show.
No problem.
Yeah, no, he was badgering me a little bit, saying, when am I going to have him on? And ironically, you know, with the front office news going on, it was perfect timing to have you jump on and kind of talk a little bit about the dealings and the way that front office life works with the Phoenix Suns. Like I said, you were there from 06 to 2012. You dealt with a couple of different regimes, from the D'Antonis to the Steve Kerrs to the Babby Blanks group. Talk a little bit about what you did with the Phoenix Suns and about your tenure overall.
So I started as an intern in the 06-07 season. During that time, I did mostly draft analytic work and a bunch of video on the draft that year, so a lot in the draft prep. At the end of that year, I was upgraded, I guess you call it, basketball operations assistant. And what that basically meant was I was a video coordinator, and then I had everything that I was doing in my internship to continue doing. Did that, and then when Coach D'Antoni left and Coach Porter came in, they basically upgraded me up to the front office, and I was assistant director of basketball ops. Did that for 3 years, and then my final year I was a full-time scout, full-time college scout, and that's where I ended up when I left in 2012.
So the cream rose to the top, and then unfortunately, like you said, you're out of there in 2012. So you had risen up from intern all the way up to scouting, and that had to be pretty interesting and pretty awesome for you, that in a, you know, 5 to 6 year window, you went from intern to actual NBA professional scout. How awesome was that?
It was awesome. Not so much where I ended up at the end, but. You know, when I came in under David Griffin, and he was a guy that he's a VP of basketball operations now in Cleveland. But he was a long time kind of number two guy in Phoenix. And it was kind of along the lines of the entire organization. We were really big on personal development, professional development. And so the people I worked for really took an interest in who I wanted to be in this industry. And where they thought I could go. And, you know, Griff, definitely he's my mentor. Mark West and Steve Kerr, who came at the end of my first year. All three of those guys really. And Todd Quinter. Excuse me, Todd Quinter is director of player personnel in Charlotte now. All four of those guys really looked out for me and helped me grow as an individual within the organization. So that was a really good feeling. And the good feeling isn't, you know, a title or, you know, doing something that sounds cool. Good feelings when you're working with good people who have a vested interest in seeing you succeed.
With your time in the organization there between 2006 and 2012, you had a chance to work with several different regimes, as Chris had said. What were some of the stylistic differences or approaches that some of the front office took between those regimes, the D'Antoni to the Kerr to now the Lon Babbie era?
Right. So Mike's era was, you know, he was coaching. So, and this goes, I believe this goes across the board. If you are a coach / GM, in this league at least, and I don't know how it is in other sports, but in basketball, 99% of those guys, unless you're just an incredible multitasker who never sleeps, you're really not worried about the big picture stuff. You're more worried about your coaching job. So Mike was, you know, he was 6'7". We were one of the two or three best teams in the NBA. And the onus was on us to win the championship. Mike's not going to be too worried about the draft in February and March. But the other part of it also is Mike's personality is very much that of kind of personal responsibility. He just kind of assumes everybody's going to get everything done. And that extends to his coaching as well. So a lot of people would say, well, Mike never coaches defense. Well, from what I saw, you know, and I was with the guy for 2 years, Mike's thing isn't that he doesn't coach defense, is that we're going to talk about the defensive principles, we're going to talk about what we're going to do defensively, and then expect everyone to execute. You know, is he a drill guy? Is he going to drill defenses, you know, shell drills every single day so that the guys that don't pick up on things quickly can get better? No, he's not that. He's more of, hey, we say we're going to show hard on high pick and rolls, and we're going to try everything on the sidelines. Why do we need to belabor the point? So that's kind of followed his management style as well. Steve and Griff were more of this kind of collaborative environment. So we have our scouts, and, you know, it wasn't a big staff back then. It was probably, a couple of full-time guys, a couple of regional guys. But it was a lot of communication, a lot of, you know, person-to-person communication and group communication. And then when we got together as a group, we'd watch film as a group. And we'd argue, and everyone would come to the table with an informed opinion. Because everyone had watched everybody, not only on film, but in person. And there was never a feeling of, well, I can't speak this way to David Griffin. He's a VP, and I'm a lowly scout, or I'm a lowly intern, or whatever the case may be. If you did your work, if we all knew and respected that you were someone who watched the film and watched players and done your work pretty much, you were able to say pretty much anything in that room. And there was no hard feelings or anything like that. They wouldn't agree with you. They might disagree. You might get into even heated arguments about players. And I can think of many times where we've gone back and forth on people. But it never was a case of, watch yourself. Remember your station. Remember who you are. Remember who you're talking to. He never had that feeling at all. When Lon and Lance came in, I think Lon came from a background of, you know, a law office, of regular business, industry America, hierarchy, you know, chain of command. And his thing was mainly, and in some ways it's good, to bring some organization, some order. This is what we're going to talk about. We have minutes, you know, someone taking down notes of what was discussed, and then a memo goes around and all that. But in some ways, it really stifled, I felt, like the creative argument that we used to really, really brainstorm some great ideas and great opinions on it. And then as far as Lance, his thing was always siloed. So he wanted you in a bucket, and he didn't want you to get out of that bucket. He didn't want, you know, he wanted everybody in separate kind of silos, as he would say, and then they would all report the information back to him, and then he would make whatever decision he would make. He rarely imparted his own opinion into the proceedings. And again, I found that difficult. I also found it difficult for that, even if there was a discussion about players or draft picks or what have you, the two highest ranking people in the room were usually ignorant of the players being spoken about. So Lon and Lance weren't watching guys every day, and they weren't traveling out and scouting. They would go on trips every now and then, but they weren't really, they didn't come from that background of watching film religiously, you know, like David Griffin, the next video coordinator, like Todd Quinter, the next video coordinator. Even the guys that weren't, guys like I said, like John Shumate, he was our head scout. He's still there at Woodstone. Mark West, still there at Woodstone, VP of player programs. These were guys that watched film. And they were no strangers to watching film. And Steve, of course. So it's kind of hard to get into these conversations with people when they don't really have the most informed opinion about the talent that's being discussed. So that was kind of the three different styles. You know, Mike was, hey, I trusted you guys in getting it done. I'm worried about something a lot more important. And I think I was rightfully so in his case. Steve and Griff were more, hey, guys, we're all going to get this together. And we all come to the table as equals, as long as we're all doing our work. And then Lon and Lance were more of the one-way street. You're going to give us information. We won't give you anything back. We'll make our decision based on the information you give.
So question for you, though, and just more or less like a yes or no response. But if you're the president of basketball operations, you're Lon Babby, is it your job to be on the road scouting players, though? I mean, just in your opinion, in like a yes or a no kind of an answer.
I can't answer that with just a yes or no. I would say this. In a traditional sense, yes, but that's not a traditional front office, and they've acknowledged that. When Lon came in, he said, my job is not to know players because I don't know players. I haven't scouted. I'm not that well versed. So in Lon's vision, very openly, he has a GM who does that. And then Lon takes care of the big six items, how much to pay people, you know, maintaining fiscal responsibility, et cetera. So under that structure, he doesn't have to. Now, do I think he should? Absolutely. I think he needs to, not maybe not to the level of a scout, but at least to have a bare minimum kind of feel for what people are talking about. You know, if we're going to talk about, Marcus Smart, for instance, he should be able to at least know that Marcus Smart can't shoot, or is not that great of a perimeter shooter, or that he uses his size to gain his advantage. He should know these things. He doesn't have to know. Marcus Smart likes to go, you know, over his left shoulder more often. He doesn't need to know that kind of level of detail, but he needs to know, I think, a very superficial level of who people are and what they do.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And so from a non-traditional front office standpoint, the reason I ask that is for this question then. If they're going to run a non-traditional front office, whereas most teams have, you know, if you're in a basketball front office, you should know basketball. You should know players. You should know either the NBA or the college game, international game. You've got to be an expert on basketball. But if they're running it in this non-traditional manner and Lon Babby is the behind-the-scenes guy that's doing everything that we don't see but should hopefully translate to something positive on the basketball court, then when you're looking for a general manager and, you know, you're setting that up, what kind of a mind do you need to come in to be able to be the general manager when basically half of your front office is dealing with finance and behind-the-scenes stuff, and then your general manager's got to come in and kind of carry the load for what you should be doing basketball-wise?
And by the way, I don't want to diminish what Lon does. What Lon does, I mean, it is pretty complex. And it does require a kind of the legalistic mind that he has. And his contribution should not be, it's not like he's an absentee landlord. I don't want to make it seem like that. But to answer your question, the kind of general manager you would need in this non-traditional office, this non-traditional structure, is someone who is an unequivocal basketball junkie, someone who lives it, someone who, in the middle of summer, when they're playing the European Championship qualifiers from the B division to come up to the A division, this is someone who's not, if he's not there watching it, he should at least be watching the film, getting it from the video coordinators, knowing what's going on. Because basically, you're, like you said, you're having to hold up that end of the bargain that the other decision maker in the front office does not do, because he's holding up an end of the bargain that you don't do. So So that's the kind of mind you want. You want someone who, when I say Volmo Caleb, you say, okay, he plays in Turkey. He's having a bad season. They didn't like him in Turkey. They think he overpaid for the guy. He was really good in Italy last year, though. He's one of the best players in Europe, and he's got a European passport, and he was one of the best players in Europe. So you want someone who will rattle off these things, and not just about Volmo Caleb, but, you know, even smaller names, you know, names that people may not know about, you know, the guys that are hoop summing, the guys that are going to Treviso in June. That's the kind of mind you want. And I'm not sure Lance Blank was that kind of guy. I guess, you know, I don't want to just leave it hanging out there. What I'm saying now is that Lance wasn't that guy. And that's why I think, you know, the last couple of years have not gone as smoothly as they probably should have.
You spoke that there was more of an open door, collaborative type of policy in place prior to Lon and Lance coming on. When I spoke with Channing a little ways back, he had said that Sarver took a vested interest in his personal life, and a lot of people have reinforced that Sarver is very, very welcoming in terms of the players, and he takes that vested interest in their family lives, everything like that. Was that something that the previous GM, Kerr, David Griffin, were more hands-on in terms of taking that role and knowing where the players were and developing that relationship? How was that different between them and the way it was under Lon and Lance?
Right. So, first of all, just to answer your question, absolutely. I think what Robert has done from that standpoint in the last few years is in reaction to filling the void that was left by Steve and Griff. Steve, first of all, as you probably know, and for all your listeners, you watch him on TV and you think, wow, he's such an easygoing guy. He gets along with everybody. He communicates very well. Absolutely 100% translates to him as a GM, as a president of basketball. He was a great communicator and could relate to so many different people on so many levels. And, you know, because here's a guy that experienced the absolute height of basketball success. I mean, to a level that I don't know anyone else other than maybe Phil Jackson and, Bill Russell probably experienced, you know. And yet, he was a work player. So he still has that humility of knowing, hey, you know, it wasn't me that did all that. You know, that was Mike, that was Scotty, and I just played my part. And so he has that. He's able to relate to, he grew up overseas for a part of his life. His father, as we all know, was a professor at the American University in Beirut. So he appeals to the star players because, his relationship with Michael and Scotty and these other guys. But he appeals to role players. He appeals to the international guys. He appeals to people like me. He appeals to everybody. And Steve was really good about that. And Griff, also incredible people person. I mean, this is a guy who really got by in life with his ability to, first of all, an incredible memory. And that doesn't just, most time when we say talent evaluator has an incredible memory, we say, oh, that means he just remembers where everybody plays and their games and kind of from a technical standpoint. But Griff had an incredible ability to take that and apply it to personal life. So he knows how many kids each player has. He knows the names of the kids. He knows the names of the wife. He knows everything about their life. He's very up to speed. Even when he's not around, he knows everything that's going on. It's not like he'll be gone on the road for 2 weeks, come back and say, oh, Channing, your wife had the baby or not? Oh, no, not yet? Okay. He knows. He knows the baby was born. He knows the gender. He knows the name. He knows everything. So both of those guys in tandem were just really, really good at connecting with people and making them feel important and making them feel cared about. And you can probably hear it in my voice. And I started when you guys asked me, how awesome was it to go from intern to scout? And I said, no, the awesome part was there were people who wanted to see me make that transition. And when I say that, those are the two main guys, and obviously there were other people along the way that I named that also played a big role. But Steve and Bruce were the ones. You know, Steve was a guy that when you were sending players down to the G League, down to Iowa, he made me go down there. And he made me, and this was not in my job description, but he made me, you know, prepare the, you know, he said, okay, this is what you have to first alert the affiliate before you alert the league, because the affiliate likes to kind of make the press release before the league puts it out. So, you know, he showed me little things like that, and they made me go down there and connect and to make sure you talk to Nick Nurse, who, by the way, just won the D-League championship with Rio Grande now. But, you know, made sure I had a connection with the coaches down there. Made sure, so they were kind of grooming me to be more than what I was at the time. And that's the kind of people they were.
Yeah, and when, so we're talking about all these different stories, these different intangibles, these different little things from, and I think to this point, to be able to, you know, with your basketball knowledge, it helps you out by being under three regimes, but probably would help the Suns out being under one particular regime for that entire time, I would imagine. Kind of, it sounds like, you know, Steve Kerr and those guys, they were starting to put it together, but they saw the writing on the wall and they ended up probably leaving at the right time. And now they're both doing things that I don't think they regret that they're doing today. But when you look around, you have a basketball knowledge, you were in a front office, you know who's in other front offices, you know guys that were in your shoes that had probably aspirations of being general managers, and that's what the Suns are looking for. And a couple of names that were mentioned, obviously, you know, there's going to be names that are mentioned, and you have guys like, you know, Jeff Weltman, you have guys like Ryan McDonough, you have guys, you know, like Mark Warkentine over in New York, a lot of guys that are being referenced as potential guys who could be, you know, the replacement out here. And Jeff Weltman is a guy who's catching a lot of steam, apparently, with the Phoenix Suns, even though he inked a four-year deal recently with Milwaukee to stay there through, I believe, 2016 or 2017. So, I mean, he's got a job there for a while if he wants it. But when you look at the landscape of the NBA, I'm huge on Ryan McDonough. I think I said that name wrong the first time. I'm huge on him over with Boston because he's a guy that came out of the video room and is that basketball junkie. But who are some names that you think, I don't know if you can speculate or if you don't want to speculate, but some guys that make some sense or guys who are potential general managers that maybe the Suns should be looking at, those basketball junkies?
Right. So I'd rather not say names, but I'd rather kind of describe what that person should be like.
That's fair.
And then you can take that to apply to whatever. Because I don't, you know, when you're talking about people who are already employed to help, you know how the room mill goes.
Yeah.
So obviously, basketball junkie is one. An ability to relate and connect with people is a big one. An acceptance of advanced stats. It doesn't have to be a stat guy. You don't have to be Daryl Morey. But you have to at least accept that there is a place for this and not just give it lip service, but actually understand where that place is and to be frank, make an effort to actually understand it. So I think what sometimes people get in the trouble of is, yeah, we got a stats department, and then it's either one or two things. Either you got a stats department and you don't listen to them, or you blindly listen to them. And both of those are equally simple, because it's not an exact science. You have to be able to correctly know the right questions to challenge what's being presented to you, but not just reject it blindly based on the fact that, well, I know what my eyes say. It's a very fine line to walk for talent evaluators. But you kind of have to combine these three things. Now, the problem is, when you talk about who this candidate is going to be, this mysterious next general manager, is if you're talking about someone who hit the home run in every single one of these categories, you're probably talking about someone who is a leader of an organization candidate. Because, let's be honest, the general manager job in Phoenix right now is an assistant general manager job. When we say general manager, we are assuming it's someone who has complete control over the basketball operation. And that's not what this job is. You don't. You have a big role. You have a huge role. You might even, you know, you could argue I have a much bigger role than what an assistant general manager would usually have. And I would say fair. But let me put it this way. If the Anaheim Amigos
are the 31st NBA team, for instance, and they decide, hey, we need to hire a general manager, I think we can all agree that that position and the Suns' open position are not the same thing.
Agreed.
One guy is going to be calling the shots. One guy is going to be answering to someone who is not the owner, who is the level below the owner. So you're talking about someone who brings those traits, but at the same time is not so accomplished that he's overqualified for the position. And that kind of can start to frame the type of candidates realistically that you're talking about.
And I don't think anyone disagrees with those qualities, and I know Jim definitely doesn't disagree with those qualities in terms of a general manager. We've been kind of debating about this on what the Suns should be looking for ever since the position became available, and it's almost the antithesis of what they just had. They need a guy who's a people person, a guy who's there, a guy who's constantly watching film, and a guy who is, you know, when he gets in the eyes of the media or the fans, he's engaging in some light. I'm not saying you need to be a stand-up comedian or, you know, a charming actor, but you need to be good enough in the light of the eyes of the fans and the media, so that way when you do make mistakes, they're a little bit more forgiving and you're a little bit more endearing to them. So that's something that Lance Blanks didn't have. If Lance Blanks was out there with the media and with the fans and became endeared to us, I'm pretty sure that he could have been forgiven for a couple of bad moves. Now, obviously, pretty much everything ended up being negative along his line there. But, you know, if you have those relationships, then you can easily forgive a mistake or two. And that's something I think the Suns really do need to keep in mind with this.
Well, I think, you bring up a great point. It at the very least, it buys you time. Because we all know some things are mistakes. And then some things just need time. I have a thing that all my friends know, I always blurt this one out. Sometimes you got to bake the cake at 400 degrees at 20 minutes. Can you bake it at 800 and expect to get it done in 10? No. 20 minutes, 400 degrees, that's just the way it is. So sometimes there are decisions that people make. On the outset, doesn't look like a good decision, but you got to give it time to develop. And over time, oh my God, it really was, a terrific decision. Good example, Goran Dragic. We drafted him, and he wasn't quite ready to come out as a rookie and play. And there were people that bashed us. But we knew what we saw in him, and we knew there was no rush for him to be incredible because Steve was there. And sure enough, over time, he grew into the player that we thought he could become. And then he took a little detour, and now he's back, and he's pretty much what we imagined him to be. So, there's some decisions that we'll make that won't immediately be, the best thing ever coming out the tour. But that's why, like you said, you have to have a good relationship with the fans. That's why you have to have a good relationship with the media. That's why you have to have a good relationship internally with your staff, with the players, with the trainers, with the coaches. Because you want people to believe in what you're doing so that when you do things, it's not just that we give you a pass. He screwed up, but he's a nice guy. I like him. It's not that. It's that, it's not looking good, but he says it's going to work out. So I trust him. I believe in him. And that's what Stephen Griff had. When they said to people, this kid right here is going to be good, people didn't believe it at first, but it ended up being, they were able to see it out. Same thing with, going back a little bit, Cotton Fitzsimmons. When people booed Dan Majerle being the pick, Cotton said, you guys are going to regret booing this kid. And Cotton wasn't under fire. He didn't worry about his job because everybody knew and trusted Cotton. They may not have agreed with the pick at the time, but they said, hey, I know Cotton, or, as well as people think they know people through the media and through television, that I know Cotton, and Cotton's a good guy, and he knows basketball. And if he says this guy's going to work out, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and let him work out. And work out he did. And so, and when you shun these other areas, even for someone like myself, I wasn't a big decision maker. I was low on the totem pole. But it was important for me to have relationships with people in the media, in other parts of the organization, in the locker room. Because I wanted people to trust when I said something that I believe in me because he's a good guy. He doesn't look down at his nose at me, and he's not secretive. He's very open. If he tells me something, I'm going to believe it because I believe he's telling me the truth. And that's that's the crux of it. And that's why the general manager job here is that's a big part of it. You know, even though you're not the number one guy, even though you're not calling a shot, you still have to have that trait about you for people to believe in what you're doing.
Yeah, and that's on another level important. And one little thing with your Goran Dragic anecdote there is that is something that Steve Kerr can sell when you get drafted 45, and it's a little bit harder to sell when you're drafting someone 13. So that's where you end up having. I mean, with 45, if you're getting bashed for taking a kid at 45 that's not ready right away, your fans might just have too high of expectations. But ended up being a great pick at 45. And then it's a little different.
Hold on, we drafted him 45. We paid him like he was 15.
Yeah, that's true.
We paid him like he was a 15th overall pick, and we guaranteed 3 years, so we actually got a better deal than the 15th overall pick that year, which was Robin Lopez. His deal, money-wise, was the same as Robin's, but he didn't have to prove himself for 2 years. He had 3 years to prove himself.
Okay, so now that we're talking about the draft, a little getting into that, I would be remiss not to venture into that topic a little bit. I know with the Suns' bifurcated brain trust that they have now, that's going to be a little bit different than the way most teams conduct their business, but how does that stuff work heading up to the draft, and how has that evolved or devolved over the last couple of years while you were in place there? So, like, do the Suns have a draft board that is in a state of constant flux moving up to that date where they have players ranked 1 through 60 and beyond that? What kind of the scouting is going into that? What happens with the draft, like the war room, and how far ahead of those types of dates, like the draft and free agency, is like a plan, at least a tentative plan of what their goals are kind of set in place? Can you kind of talk about maybe a little bit of how that situation plays out?
As far as the current regime?
No, I mean, like I said, as far as how that's evolved over the years.
Right. Basketball operations in general, everyone has a big board. Everyone has a room for the current regime, they actually have a room. Previously, we did it all electronically. We'd have a whiteboard that we'd write stuff on. We would often write misinformation on that board in case anyone saw it and, thought they had a hot scoop. But the real deal stuff was all electronic. So, and we'd rank maybe not 1 through 60, definitely 1 through 30, and then after that, it kind of devolves into more generic groupings, high second round, mid second round. Look, it's impossible to kind of predict those types of things. There's too much variance going on to say, oh, yeah, he's 47, but at 48, that's too low. You can't make that call. For the draft, you have this ranking going throughout the year, but then obviously towards, after college season, and towards the draft, it starts to pick up a little bit more. For free agency, this is where it differs. For us, under current list, it was, more of the same. We still had those conversations because, again, our staff wasn't that big. A lot of the same people who were scouting college were also scouting pro. So we, such as myself, Todd Quitter, the conversation just shifted right into the next thing. Whereas the current regime, or at least when I left it, I don't know how they've adjusted since, but again, they have those silos. So the college guys did only college. And after the draft, shake your hand, thanks a lot, guys. Who's going to LeBron? Who's going to, the Nike camps, pretty much? And who's going to the global challenge and all that? But they didn't really have much of a say in free agency. So then it kind of shifted to more Lon Lance and John Seward. And then, whoever they had who was full scouting that year. So it's kind of tough to describe because it's such an overarching operation. And everybody does it different.
there are going to be similarities from team to team, but everybody's got their own style. So, you know, it's tough to really describe. I guess the most generic thing I can say to you is that they're ranking top 30. They're looking at the different positions. They're ranking by position as well. And they are trying to figure out grouping as far as realistically who can we expect to be around when we pick here, who can we expect to be around when we pick here, and then, you know, and on and on.
Yeah, makes sense. And sometimes you got to be careful with too much information and all of that stuff. And speaking of too much information, it's hard to keep these podcasts concise when there's smart people talking, which is why me and Jim just kind of faded into the background and let Amin take the wheel for a little while. But no, I'll let you get out of here. But before we do, definitely want to make sure we give you a quick plug. You're on Twitter. You use Twitter like most people should. You link your work, and you're sarcastic and you're knowledgeable, which are the three things you have to be on Twitter. So make sure you follow Amin at Amin, A-M-I-N, ESPN, because he's writing for ESPN. And also, like, everybody makes the correlation. Just don't buy one cup of coffee a month and sign up for ESPN Insider. You get the magazine. You get to read Amin's articles. You get to read guys like Kevin Pelton and all these other guys' great work on ESPN. So definitely, like I said, just don't buy one cup of coffee once a month. That's it. You got 29 other days to enjoy that hot coffee. But jump on there. Definitely get the Insider subscription. Check him out on Twitter. And great stuff. I mean, I definitely appreciate you jumping on.
Thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I mean, if sarcastic and knowledgeable is your profile, I might have to follow you on Twitter, because that is my perfect description, too.
No refund.
No refunds on Twitter and no refunds on the podcast. All right, I mean, we'll catch you up. We'll catch up with you later on, probably throughout the summer or next year, man.
All right, guys.
Again, special thanks to Amin jumping on. He's, like I said, ESPN Insider. Spend that couple extra bucks, you know, a month. You just buy it all at once. So, but definitely get on there. Check out his stuff that he writes. He was with the Phoenix Suns for a handful of years doing a multitude of different jobs. And whenever at Suns games, he was the guy that I would always just sit there and talk potential NBA draft stuff with. And it's always nice to get a guy who was an NBA scout talking NBA draft stuff. So that ended up running long. We had some other things on the agenda that me and Jim were going to cover. But what we're going to do is we're either going to throw up a part two on Friday. Don't hold us to that. I don't want to give you guys false expectations like some other things have. But we're thinking about throwing a part two up on Friday to kind of keep the conversation going. If not, same time next week. Thanks for listening. Episode 21. Appreciate the time, guys. And we'll catch up with you guys soon.